This is March 29th, 2009, and I'm going to read from and comment on an article about insight today. This is from the New York Times. It's last July, and it's called The Eureka Hunt. Why do good ideas come to us when they do? Now, this is an article that is has so much about so much you could say about Zen in this article, and two local members gave me this article. I've just been waiting for the right time to read from it. It's by Jonah Lehrer, L-E-H-R-E-R, Jonah Lehrer. The Eureka Hunt. He begins by describing this notorious forest fire in 1949 in Montana. The fire was started by lightning, and a team of firefighters were sent there in a C-47 cargo plane. They were told the fire was small, just a few burning acres, but the wind kicked up, and they found themselves trapped. There were 14 of them, and the boss, his name was Wag Dodge, believe it or not, Wag Dodge. And it says here, Dodge screamed at his men to retreat. They dropped their gear and started running up the steep canyon walls, trying to reach the top of the ridge. And then he looked over his shoulder and saw that the fire was less than 50 yards away, and he realized that the blaze could not be outrun. The gulch was too steep, the flames too fast. So he stopped running, this Wag Dodge. He stopped running, and I'll read here from the article. The decision wasn't as suicidal as it appeared. In a moment of desperate insight, he had devised an escape plan. He lit a match and ignited the ground in front of him, the flames quickly moving up the grassy slope. Then Dodge stepped into the shadow of his fire, so that he was surrounded by a buffer of burned land. He wet his handkerchief with water from his canteen, clutched the cloth to his mouth, and lay down on the smoldering embers. He closed his eyes and tried to inhale the thin layer of oxygen clinging to the ground. Then he waited for the fire to pass over him. 13 smoke jumpers died in the Man Gulch fire. White crosses below the ridge still mark the spots where the men died. But after several terrifying minutes, Dodge emerged from the ashes virtually unscathed. And then the author goes on. There is something inherently mysterious about moments of insight. Wag Dodge, for instance, could never explain where his idea for the escape fire came from. He quotes him as saying, it just seemed the logical thing to do. His improbable survival has become one of those legendary stories of insight, like Archimedes shouting Eureka when he saw his bathwater rise, or Isaac Newton watching an apple fall from a tree and then formulating his theory of gravity. Such tales all share a few essential features which psychologists and neuroscientists use to define, quote, the insight experience. The first of these is the impasse. Before there can be a breakthrough, there has to be a mental block. Wag Dodge spent minutes running from the fire, although he was convinced that doing so was futile. Then, when the insight arrived, Dodge immediately realized that the problem was solved. This is another key feature of insight. the feeling of certainty that accompanies the idea. Dodge didn't have time to think about whether his plan would work. He simply knew that it would. This, parallels here with enlightenment are obvious, but to just see in terms of enlightenment would be too limited a way to understand this, what we're going to be reading. It's really any kind of insight. And there are many insights that may precede actual awakening. Simple little philosophical insights, psychological insights, insights about a relationship, a difficult or a confounding relationship one has with someone in one's immediate family or with someone at work or elsewhere. It's also applicable to, obviously it's applicable to koans, but more than that, it's really the kind of problems, if you can call them that, it's the kind of problems in Zen that we face in our sitting include also just the general problem of becoming one with the breath, with or the koan, whatever it is that seems to be an object out there apart from us. And that really is what it comes down to. Whether one's practice is a breath practice or a koan, it's becoming one with what appears to be two, or just closing the illusion of subject and object as separate. So before there can be a breakthrough, there has to be a mental block. Or in Zen terms, there has to be, you could say, a struggle. There has to be a feeling of being blocked. And anyone who's sat for more than an hour knows that feeling of facing the frustration of feeling unable to become one with the practice. And then we're going to, as usual, have to skip some paragraphs here. It gets quite into the neuroscience of insight, some of which we can read, but other not. He gets into the difference between the two hemispheres of the brain, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, and he just lays out some basic differences there. He says if the left hemisphere excelled at, well, just very briefly, the neuroscientists generally link the left hemisphere with the verbal functions, verbal and logical functions, and the right hemisphere with the rest. So he says here, if the left hemisphere excelled at denotation, that is storing the primary meaning of a word, the right hemisphere dealt with connotation, everything that gets left out of a dictionary definition, such as the emotional charge in a sentence or a metaphor. And then he quotes this one researcher by the name of Jung Beeman. It's a hyphenated last name, Jung Beeman. Language is so complex that the brain has to process it in two different ways at the same time. It needs to see the forest and the trees. The right hemisphere is what helps you see the forest. In other words, the big picture. is more the province of the right hemisphere. Now, we got into this last summer, not long before this New Yorker article came out in a Teisho about the insight that came to this neuroscientist Jill Bolte Taylor, who had a stroke and found after her stroke that she had a whole new access to what the right hemisphere, and it gave her a sense of, for the first time in her life, of the underlying unity within the world of differentiation, the world of self and other, us and them, right and wrong, all that what she ascribed to the right hemisphere was seeing beyond all that, all those differences and discriminations, and it was enormously liberating for her. I won't rehash some of the points I made in that teisho, except one, which is that it came to me from one of our members who's a neurologist, who pointed out after reading that article by Taylor that the distinction of left hemisphere and right hemisphere is a conceptual artifact, he said. The more we learn about the brain, the more complex it becomes. Everything in the brain is interconnected, like Indra's net. In fact, even the brain-body dichotomy is dissolving. So we just take with a little grain of salt what the distinctions it makes between the left hemisphere and right hemisphere, and remember that these there's only one brain. They're connected, and that's actually very reassuring, because he gets into a little bit later how you can't leave out either side. One of my problems with the research and the conclusions that Taylor came to is that she seemed to come very close to saying right hemisphere good, left hemisphere bad. But we all know that you can't reject half of the brain. It's very vital part of it. And part of, not just part of, you know, language, but part of the insight itself, the whole process of insight. I like this distinction where he makes between the left hemisphere excelling at denotation and the right hemisphere connotation. In Zen, we are always urged to try to see not just the words of a koan or of anything, daily life, the words of what your spouse says to you or what your kids say to you or what your boss or employees say to you, not just the denotation, but what's behind the words, the spirit behind the words. And that's he says, is the work of the right hemisphere. Skipping here, a Jung Beeman began searching in the right hemisphere for the source of insight in the brain. He decided to compare puzzles solved in moments of insight with those solved by methodical testing of potential solutions, in which people could accurately trace their thought process and had no sense of surprise when the answer came. So this second type of problem solving, the methodical testing of potential solutions, I would say that the best example, well, the example that comes to my mind of that is Thomas Edison's patient working his way through the problem of finding the right material for the filament of an incandescent bulb. He famously is said to have tried 2,000 different materials before he hit on tungsten or whatever it was. It's a story I've told. I'm sure it's been told at many Zen centers of of how important just the legwork is in Zen practice, and how the important role of perseverance. When a reporter said to Thomas Edison, how did it feel to fail 2,000 times? And he said, fail? I invented the light bulb. How is that a failure? He said, it just took me 2,000 tries to get there. But still, in his case, in the case of his discovery, this would be the more analytic method. This would be employing the analytical mind and methodically testing the different solutions and being able to trace that later. Whereas the article is focusing more on the kind of insight that comes to us unbidden as a marvelous surprise, which would be the types that we have in sitting, not just sesshin. These can happen outside sesshin, and they don't even have to be limited to while we're sitting. They come to us. It's like this type of insight is really a gift. The feeling is that it's not something we did, even though there may be a huge amount of zazen that preceded this gift. Still, we know when something like this comes to us that we didn't do it. There is no I to have done it. That's one of the common features of such insights, whether it's awakening or a lesser insight. Skipping a few more paragraphs here. He refers to some studies in 2004 and 2006 that found that people who solved puzzles with the insight activated, with the people who solved puzzles with insight, that's, you know, not the methodical analytical way, activated a specific subset of cortical areas in the brain. Although the answer seemed to appear out of nowhere, the mind was carefully preparing itself for the breakthrough. The first areas activated during the problem-solving process were those involved with executive control, like the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex. The scientists refer to this as the preparatory phase, since the brain is devoting its considerable computational power to the problem. The various sensory areas, like the visual cortex, go silent as the brain suppresses possible distractions. And he quotes this researcher again, Jung Biemann, as saying, the cortex does this for the same reason we close our eyes when we're trying to think. Focus is all about blocking stuff out. So now this is the first stage, and you know, the masters figure this out centuries, millennia ago, that you start by focusing, and to some extent that does mean blocking stuff out. This is why in sesshin, it is so important to keep the eyes down at all times, because this is where it starts, the focus. In fact, more than one of the major rules of sesshin are for the purpose of getting us to stop grasping at externals and turn the mind around into this focus. What happens next, continuing reading here, is the search phase, as the brain starts looking for answers in all the relevant places. Because these researchers were giving people word puzzles, they saw additional activity in areas related to speech and language. The search can quickly get frustrating, and it takes only a few seconds before people say they've reached an impasse, that they can't think of the right word. Almost all of the possibilities your brain comes up with are going to be wrong, Jung Beeman said, and it's up to the executive control areas to keep on searching or, if necessary, change strategies and start searching somewhere else. I think of another example I've used in Sesshin of searching for your keys. Most of us probably have had the experience of about to leave the house, and we pat our pockets and look for the keys where they usually are, and they're no keys, and we start looking, searching, and you start looking in all of the reasonable places, and usually you find the keys, but sometimes you don't. And then, everyone knows this, when you've looked in all the reasonable places, then you start looking in the unreasonable places. You start letting go of the reasoning mind and broaden your search. And if you persist at this long enough and still haven't found your keys, then this is what gets us into what in Zen we call the doubt sensation, the questioning, wondering mind. The example that Roshi Kaplow used in the Three Pillars of Zen is a man is sitting in his room, smoking a pipe, and the next thing he knows, he can't find the pipe. And he just looks and looks in the cushions, he looks on the table, on the floor, under the chair, and so forth. He looks everywhere and can't find the pipe that was in his hands a few minutes ago. Now he knows that he hasn't left the room. No one has come into the room. The pipe has to be there. Does this sound familiar to anyone? It has to be there. By God, I'm going to find it. Here, the doubt sensation is in direct proportion to the faith that the pipe is there. You know, if you weren't sure, if people had come in and gone out, you wouldn't be left so perplexed. But because you know that the pipe has to be there and yet you can't find it, that you are driven into a state of increasingly profound perplexity. Where he says here, the search can quickly get frustrating. This is one of the main obstructions to ongoing practice, is frustration. And surely everyone has had to deal, whoever has stuck with this long enough has had to deal with frustration. And that's one of the great benefits of Zen practice, Sesshin or outside of Sesshin, is persevering through frustration. And that takes faith. But back to the narrative here of this article. He says, but sometimes, just when the brain is about to give up, an insight appears. And then it quotes a graduate student researcher who says, you'll see people bolt up in their chair and their eyes go all wide. Sometimes they even say, aha, before they blurt out the answer. The suddenness of the insight comes with a burst of brain activity. All right, so a split second before the participant communicates the answer, the EEG registers a spike of gamma rhythm, which is the highest electrical frequency generated by the brain. It's as if the insight had gone incandescent. Gamma rhythm is thought to come from the binding of neurons as cells distributed across the cortex draw themselves together into a new network, which is then able to enter consciousness. Then it says that there's a little fold of tissue on the surface of the right hemisphere, the anterior superior temporal gyrus, which became unusually active in the second before the insight. The activation was sudden and intense, a surge of electricity leading to a rush of blood. Although the function of this fold remains mostly a mystery, the brain is stuffed with obscurities. Jung Beeman wasn't surprised to see it involved with the insight process. A few previous studies had linked the area to aspects of language comprehension, such as the detection of literary themes and the interpretation of metaphors. A related area was implicated in the processing of jokes. Jung Beeman argues that these linguistic skills, like insight, require the brain to make a set of distant and unprecedented connections. Just let me mention that one way of understanding koans is as metaphors. Koans are metaphors. To continue now, the insight process is a delicate mental balancing act. At first, the brain lavishes the scarce resource of attention on a single problem. But once the brain is sufficiently focused, the cortex needs to relax in order to seek out the more remote association in the right hemisphere, which will provide the insight. The relaxation phase is crucial, Jung Beeman said. That's why so many insights happen during warm showers. Cold showers, not so much, I guess. Another ideal moment for insights, according to the scientists, is the early morning, right after we wake up. This is so much fun to see this confirmed, because personally, this is the moment for me that is most fertile. I can't tell you how many times I've woken up on a Sunday morning when I have to give Taisho, when things come together. I do reading. I call it the foraging phase of reading all kinds of things related to the topic. Or sometimes I don't have a topic when I wake up in the morning. But even I've done all kinds of reading, even though I hadn't settled on a topic by the time I go to bed, when I wake up, in that first 10 seconds or half a minute of consciousness, things so often just fall into place, and I suddenly find that I know now what I'm going to be giving a Taisho on, or if I already knew the night before, then the different threads that have been sort of a big tangle of different aspects of the topic sort of fold together. Sometimes, not always, but it's surprising how often I can spend hours on a Saturday without things coming together the way they do in that first 30 seconds or a minute of consciousness on Sunday morning. I'm sure other people have had this experience as well. He goes on, the drowsy brain is unwound and disorganized, open to all sorts of unconventional ideas. The right hemisphere is also unusually active. Jung Beeman said, the problem with the morning, though, is that we're always so rushed. We've got to get the kids ready for school, so we leap out of bed and never give ourselves a chance to think. Or, I don't know about that word, think. My experience is that it's not so much thinking. I'm not sitting and thinking about a problem, but it's just I'm allowing the resolution to come. I mean, not even, there's no intention. It just comes. But it is related to all the work of the previous day or two. He recommends that if we're stuck on a difficult problem, it's better to set the alarm clock a few minutes early so that we have time to lie in bed and ruminate. We do some of our best thinking when we're still half asleep. I think here, this is what we're seeing is the limits of our vocabulary, because I don't think what he's talking about is thinking in an intentional kind of problem-solving way. It is, I don't see it as trying to figure something out. Trying to figure something out is not how you resolve a koan either. I've told this to so many people when working on Mu, any of the breakthrough koans, don't even try to figure it out. No one has ever figured out Mu. It's not that kind of a problem. It's not that kind of a thing to resolve. It's all this other stuff that we're reading here. And going back to this sentence, the drowsy brain is unwound and disorganized, open to all sorts of unconventional ideas. This is one reason why throughout Zen history in Sesshin, people are urged to get no more sleep than is necessary during Sesshin. And in fact, during Sesshin, because we're using the mind in such a concentrated way, we don't need the same amount of sleep that we do outside Sesshin. People have different needs for sleep. But here, this confirms one reason, if you're not sure whether to head back to your room to sleep at night or keep sitting, one reason to keep sitting instead. Okay, you're drowsy, but good things can come out of that. There's an old saying from Japan, when you're tired, the ego is tired. As continuing here, as Jung, Beeman, and so-and-so see it, the insight process is an act of cognitive deliberation. The brain must be focused on the task at hand, transformed by accidental, serendipitous connections. We must concentrate, but we must concentrate on letting the mind wander. Here again, I think this is a misuse of the word letting the mind wander. I'll get to that in just a little bit. He refers to this particular style of thought. One of the key predictive signals of this particular style of thought, or I would say no thought, is a steady rhythm of alpha waves emanating from the right hemisphere. Alpha waves typically correlate with a state of relaxation. and such activity makes the brain more receptive to new and unusual ideas. He has also found that unless subjects have sufficient alpha wave activity, they won't be able to make use of hints the researchers give them. And I naturally think here of Doksan. And I'm recalling being on the student's mat as well as the teacher's mat in Doksan, where the teacher will offer hints or points, and if the student isn't receptive to them, then they're not going to do any good. If the student, and one way a student is not receptive is being too tense, being too nervous for the teacher. So I've, probably like many teachers, I feel an important part of giving Doksan with a beginner is to get them to relax enough where they can take in what I have to offer them. And by the way, that's not always so easy to do. And one of the ways of learning to relax enough with the teacher in Doksan is to just go to a lot of Doksans even though you're nervous. And then eventually, you know, that sort of, you settle down, and that's where the teacher can reach you. But until then, there's not too much that the teacher can do for you. To continue, one of the surprising lessons of this research is that trying to force an insight can actually prevent the insight. While it's commonly assumed that the best way to solve a difficult problem is to focus, minimize distractions, and pay attention only to the relevant details, this clenched state of mind may inhibit the sort of creative connections that lead to sudden breakthroughs. We suppress the very type of brain activity that we should be encouraging. Again here, the effort that we all make in a strenuous application of Zazen, like Sesshin, that effort really, whether we know it or not, it's all for the purpose of getting us to the point where we can relax. And many of you know this from Sesshin, that on that last, that sixth or seventh day of Sesshin, maybe we may find that we can, there's a kind of release that can happen. And one way to understand this is that we sort of, especially on the last day of Sesshin, in the closing hours of Sesshin, we kind of give up. We let go. We give up in a good sense. We let go of our grasping at this goal, whatever our goal may be, and that's when things open sometimes. But we can't start on day one or three, usually. We can't start by that kind of relaxing. We have to go through the settling of the mind before we can relax in that way. So-and-so has recently demonstrated that making people focus on the details of a visual scene as opposed to the big picture can significantly disrupt the insight process. He said, it doesn't take much to shift the brain into left hemisphere mode. That's when you stop paying attention to those more holistic associations coming in from the right hemisphere. Schooler's research has also led him to reconsider the bad reputation of letting one's mind wander. Although we often complain that the brain is too easily distracted, Schooler believes that letting the mind wander is essential. Just look at the history of science, he said. The big ideas seem to always come when people are sidetracked, when they're doing something that has nothing to do with their research. Now here, I I think it's, again, can be misleading, this phrase, letting the mind wander. What I think he's really saying, what they're saying, is not, this letting the mind wander is not just letting the mind run amok and pursuing any thought that happens to flit through the mind and going off in a train of thoughts. It doesn't mean grasping at thoughts, mental objects, images, fantasies. What this means is a state of non-abiding. It's one of the classic Buddhist words and then Buddhist texts. Non-abiding, not clinging to anything. A state of not knowing. We know that if we just sit and give way to chasing our thoughts around and our fantasies, this isn't going to get us anywhere. This idea of reaching an impasse, it's like coming to your wit's end. Wit here being used in the older sense of the word, meaning your intelligence, the work of your higher brain, your discriminating mind, coming to your wit's end. There are so many accounts, Kensho accounts, where this is described, reaching this point where you've exhausted that searching process, the grasping process, and then shift into this mind of non-grasping. Just letting things be. That's surrender in the most positive sense. Again, like Leiden Sassoon, not working in order to get something. That's as long as we're on that level, seeing Zazen as a means to an end to some goal that we want very badly, then we're not going to find it. It's surrendering to this deeper mind, maybe the right hemisphere, allowing that work, that integrative work of the right hemisphere to come forth and make those distant connections that had not previously been seen as connected. He says here, these researchers, he quotes the 19th century mathematician Poincaré, who had this seminal insight into non-Euclidean geometry. He had that insight while he was boarding a bus. At that moment, when I put my foot on the step, the idea came to me without anything in my former thoughts seeming to have paved the way for it. He insisted, the same Poincaré insisted, that the best way to think about complex problems is to immerse yourself in the problem, there's the Zazen, until you hit an impasse. Then when it seems that, quote, nothing good is accomplished, you should find a way to distract yourself, preferably by going on a walk or a journey. The answer will arrive when you least expect it. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. And then the author here says that Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, preferred the relaxed atmosphere of a topless bar where he would sip where he would sip 7-Up, watch the entertainment, and if inspiration struck, scribble equations on cocktail napkins. Again, distract yourself doesn't really convey what's happening here. It's the unclenching. But again, to unclench for people who are very obsessed or greedy for results, unclenching means exhaling and just easing off and allowing this mind of wisdom to emerge. For now, though, the science of promoting insight remains rooted in anecdote, in stories of people like Poincaré who were able to consistently induce the necessary state of mind. Kunios tells, another researcher, tells a story about an expert Zen meditator who took part in one of the CRA insight experiments. It's a certain kind of puzzle that measures insight. At first, the meditator couldn't solve any of the insight problems. Quote, this Zen guy went through 30 or so of the verbal puzzles and just drew a blank, Kunios said. He was just used to being very focused, but you can't solve these problems if you're too focused. Then, just as he was about to give up, there it is, folks, just as he was about to give up, he started solving one puzzle after another until by the end of the experiment, he was getting them all right. It was an unprecedented streak. Kunios said, normally people don't get better as the task goes along. If anything, they get a little bored. Kunios believes that the dramatic improvement of the Zen meditator came from his paradoxical ability to focus on not being focused so that he could pay attention to those remote associations in the right hemisphere. He had the cognitive control to let go, Kunios said. He became an insight machine. Yeah. The cognitive control to let go. It's always paradox. It's always paradox. We get the whole system aligned, starting with the posture, physically getting things aligned, getting things settled, arranged in place, and then getting the mind focused. And all of this in order to let go. Well, he makes the point here that there's something paradoxical and bizarre about all this. On the one hand, an epiphany is a surprising event. We are startled by what we've just discovered. Some part of our brain, however, clearly isn't surprised at all, which is why we are able to instantly recognize the insight. As soon as the insight happens, it just seems so obvious, Schooler said. People can't believe they didn't see it before. Can't tell you how many times I've had people come to me after Kensho and express exactly there. It was there all along, right in front of me. He talks about the critical role played by the prefrontal cortex, which can get pretty bad rap in Zen because of this thing about non-discrimination, which is an essential part of the practice of Zazen, not indulging in unnecessary discrimination. But here it is. There's nothing in the mind, nothing in the brain that we can reject and say is somehow a problem or in and of itself, that it's somehow wrong. I don't have time to go into this about the prefrontal cortex. So there's this long, often long toil that must precede the insights that come out of the release, the releasing of the discriminating mind. This release, this opening, happens through reaching a samadhi condition, that is a state of oneness or emptiness. All awakenings, as far as I can tell, awakening, the precondition of awakening is samadhi. And this is what is confirmed through those rare experiences of awakening experienced by people who had no Zen practice, like Flora Courtois, a college student in the 1940s, who was gripped by her own personal question, what is real? And she spent months with this question tormenting her until one day, sitting on her bed in her dorm room in Ann Arbor, suddenly everything changed. Her mind must have been empty at that moment. She couldn't have been pursuing thoughts, letting her mind wander, as we understand that, the meaning of that phrase. Who was it who said that insight is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration?
Edison,
okay. A little bit more here. This integrative theory of the prefrontal cortex suggests why we can instantly recognize the insight even when it seems surprising. The brain has been concertedly pursuing the answer, we just didn't know it. Your consciousness is very limited in capacity, Miller said, and that's why your prefrontal cortex makes all these plans without telling you about it. When that obscure circuit in the right hemisphere finally generates the necessary association, the prefrontal cortex is able to identify it instantly, and the insight erupts into awareness. We suddenly notice the music that has been playing all along. Recognition really means recognition. And then the brain cells become altered by the breakthrough. Again, this Miller, another researcher, an insight is a restructuring of information. It's seeing the same old thing in a completely new way. Once that restructuring occurs, you never go back. I want to end with the words of Simone Weil, who said, "Even if our efforts of attention seem for years to be producing no results, one day a light that is in exact proportion to them will flood the soul." Our time is up. Let's stop and recite the four vows.